Chapter 8. Create Temptation. Lure the target deep into your seduction by creating the proper temptation, a glimpse of the pleasures to come. As the serpent tempted Eve with the promise of forbidden knowledge, you must awaken a desire in your targets that they cannot control. Find that weakness of theirs, that fantasy that has yet to be realized, and hint that you can lead them toward it. It could be wealth, it could be adventure, it could be forbidden and guilty pleasures. The key is to keep it vague. Dangle the prize before their eyes, postponing satisfaction, and let their minds do the rest. The future seems ripe with possibility. Stimulate a curiosity stronger than the doubts and anxieties that go with it, and they will follow you. The Tantalizing Object. Sometime in the 1880s, a gentleman named Don Juan de Todellas was wandering through a park in Madrid when he saw a woman in her early 20s getting out of a coach, followed by a 2-year-old child and a nursemaid. The young woman was elegantly dressed, but what took Don Juan's breath away was her resemblance to a woman he'd known nearly 3 years before. Surely, she could not be the same person. The woman he had known, Cristeta Moreruela, was a showgirl in a second-rate theater. She had been an orphan and was quite poor. Her circumstances could not have changed that much. He moved closer, the same beautiful face. And then he heard her voice. He was so shocked that he had to sit down. It was indeed the same woman. Don Juan was an incorrigible seducer, whose conquests were innumerable and of every variety. But he remembered his affair with Cristeta quite clearly, because she had been so young, the most charming girl he had ever met. He had seen her in the theater, had courted her assiduously, and had managed to persuade her to take a trip with him to a seaside town. Although they had separate rooms, nothing could stop Don Juan. He made up a story about business troubles, gained her sympathy, and in a tender moment took advantage of her weakness. A few days later, he left her, on the pretext that he had to attend to business. He believed he would never see her again. Feeling a little guilty, a rare occurrence with him, he sent her 5,000 pesetas, pretending he would eventually rejoin her. Instead, he went to Paris. He had only recently returned to Madrid. As he sat and remembered all this, an idea troubled him. The child. Could the boy possibly be his? If not, she must have married almost immediately after their affair. How could she do such a thing? She was obviously wealthy now. Who could her husband be? Did he know her past? Mixed with his confusion was intense desire. She was so young and beautiful. Why had he given her up so easily? Somehow, even if she was married, he had to get her back. Don Juan began to frequent the park every day. He saw her a few more times. Their eyes met, but she pretended not to notice him. Tracing the nursemaid during one of her errands, he struck up a conversation with her and asked her about her mistress's husband. She told him the man's name was Señor Martinez and that he was away on an extended business trip. She also told him where Cristeta now lived. Don Juan gave her a note to give to her mistress. Then he strolled by Cristeta's house, a beautiful palace. His worst suspicions were confirmed. She had married money. Cristeta refused to see him. He persisted, sending more notes. Finally, to avoid a scene, she agreed to meet him just once in the park. He prepared for the meeting carefully. Seducing her again would be a delicate operation. But when he saw her coming toward him in her beautiful clothes, his emotions and his lust got the better of him. She could only belong to him. Never to another man, he told her. Cristeta took offense at this. Obviously, her present circumstances prevented even one more meeting. Still, beneath her coolness, he could sense strong emotions. He begged to see her again, but she left without promising anything. He sent her more letters, meanwhile racking his brains, trying to piece it all together. Who was this Señor Martinez? Why would he marry a showgirl? How could Cristeta be wrested away from him? Finally, Cristeta agreed to meet Don Juan one more time, in the theater where he dared not risk a scandal. They took a box where they could talk. She reassured him the child wasn't his. She said he only wanted her now because she belonged to another, because he could not have her. No, he said, he had changed. He would do anything to get her back. Disconcertingly, at moments, her eyes seemed to be flirting with him. But then she seemed to be about to cry and rested her head on his shoulder, only to get up immediately, as if realizing this was a mistake. This was their last meeting, she said, and quickly fled. Don Juan was beside himself. She was playing with him. She was a coquette. He had only been claiming to have changed, but perhaps it was true. No woman had ever treated him this way before. He would never have allowed it. For the next few nights, Don Juan slept poorly. All he could think about was Cristeta. He had nightmares about killing her husband, about growing old and being alone. It was all too much. He had to leave town. He sent her a goodbye note, and to his amazement, she replied. She wanted to see him. She had something to tell him. By now, he was too weak to resist. As she had requested, he met her on a bridge at night. This time, she made no effort to control herself. Yes, she still loved Don Juan and was ready to run away with him, but he should come to her house tomorrow in broad daylight and take her away. There could be no secrecy. Beside himself with joy, Don Juan agreed to her demands. The next day, he showed up at her palace at the appointed hour and asked for Señora Martinez. There was no one there by that name, said the woman at the door. Don Juan insisted. Her name is Cristeta. Ah, Cristeta, the woman said. She lives in the back with the other tenants. Confused, Don Juan went to the back of the palace. There he thought he saw her son playing in the street in dirty clothes. But no, he said to himself, it must be some other child. He came to Cristeta's door, and instead of her servant, Cristeta herself opened it. He entered. It was the room of a poor person. Hanging on improvised racks, however, were Cristeta's elegant clothes. As if in a dream, he sat down, dumbfounded, and listened as Cristeta revealed the truth. She was not married. She had no child. Months after he had left her, she'd realized that she had been the victim of a consummate seducer. She still loved Don Juan, but she was determined to turn the tables. Finding out through a mutual friend that he'd returned to Madrid, she took the 5,000 pesetas he had sent her and bought expensive clothes. She borrowed a neighbor's child, asked the neighbor's cousin to play the child's nursemaid, and rented a coach, all to create an elaborate fantasy that existed only in his mind. Cristeta didn't even have to lie. She never actually said she was married or had a child. She knew that being unable to have her would make him want her more than ever. It was the only way to seduce a man like him. Overwhelmed by the lengths she had gone to and by the emotions she had so skillfully stirred in him, Don Juan forgave Cristeta and offered to marry her. To his surprise, and perhaps to his relief, she politely declined. The moment they married, she said, his eyes would wander elsewhere. Only if they stayed as they were could she maintain the upper hand. Don Juan had no choice but to agree. Interpretation. Cristeta and Don Juan are characters in the novel Dulce y Sabrosa, Sweet and Savory, from 1891, by the Spanish writer Jacinto Octavio Picón. Most of Picón's work deals with male seducers and their feminine victims, a subject he studied and knew much about. Abandoned by Don Juan and reflecting on his nature, Cristeta decided to kill two birds with one stone. She would get revenge and get him back. But how could she lure such a man? The fruit once tasted, he no longer wanted it. What came easily to him or fell into his arms held no allure for him. What would tempt Don Juan into desiring Cristeta again, into pursuing her, was the sense that she was already taken, that she was forbidden fruit. That was his weakness. That was why he pursued virgins and married women, women he was not supposed to have. To a man, she reasoned, the grass always seems greener somewhere else. She would make herself that distant, alluring object, just out of reach, tantalizing him, stirring up emotions he could not control. He knew how charming and desirable she had once been to him. The idea of possessing her again and the pleasure he imagined it would bring were too much for him. He swallowed the bait. Temptation is a twofold process. First, you are coquettish, flirtatious. You stimulate a desire by promising pleasure and distraction from daily life. At the same time, you make it clear to your targets that they cannot have you, at least not right away. You are establishing a barrier, some kind of tension. In days gone by, such barriers were easy to create by taking advantage of pre-existing social obstacles of class, race, marriage, religion. Today, the barriers have to be more psychological. Your heart is taken by someone else. You're really not interested in the target. Some secret holds you back. The timing is bad. You're not good enough for the other person. The other person is not good enough for you, and so on. Conversely, you can choose someone who has a built-in barrier. They are taken. They are not meant to want you. These barriers are more subtle than the social or religious variety, but they are barriers nevertheless, and the psychology remains the same. People are perversely excited by what they cannot or should not have. Create this inner conflict. There is excitement and interest, but you are unavailable, and you will have them grasping like Tantalus for water. And as with Don Juan and Cristeta, the more you make your targets pursue you, the more they imagine that it is they who are the aggressors. Your seduction is perfectly disguised. Keys to Seduction. Most of the time, people struggle to maintain security and a sense of balance in their lives. If they were always uprooting themselves in pursuit of every new person or fantasy that passed them by, they could not survive the daily grind. They usually win the struggle, but it doesn't come easy. The world is full of temptation. They read about people who have more than they do, about adventures others are having, about people who have found wealth and happiness, the security that they strive for, and that they seem to have in their lives, is actually an illusion. It covers up a constant tension. As a seducer, you can never mistake people's appearance for reality. You know that their fight to keep order in their lives is exhausting, and that they are gnawed by doubts and regrets. It's hard to be good and virtuous, always having to repress the strongest desires. With that knowledge in mind, seduction is easier. What people want is not temptation. Temptation happens every day. What people want is to give in to temptation. To yield. That is the only way to get rid of the tension in their lives. It costs much more to resist temptation than to surrender. Your task, then, is to create a temptation that is stronger than the daily variety. It has to be focused on them, aimed at them as individuals, at their weakness. Understand, everyone has a principal weakness from which others stem. Find that childhood insecurity, that lack in their life, and you hold the key to tempting them. Their weakness may be greed, vanity, boredom, some deeply repressed desire, a hunger for forbidden fruit. They signal it in little details that elude their conscious control, their style of clothing, an offhand comment. Their past, and particularly their past romances, will be littered with clues. Give them a potent temptation, tailored to their weakness, and you can make the hope of pleasure that you stir in them figure more prominently than the doubts and anxieties that accompany it. In 1621, King Philip III of Spain desperately wanted to forge an alliance with England by marrying his daughter to the son of the English king, James I. James seemed open to the idea, but he stalled for time. Spain's ambassador to the English court, a man named Gondomar, was given the task of advancing Philip's plan. He set his sights on the king's favorite, the Duke, former Earl, of Buckingham. Gondomar knew the Duke's main weakness, vanity. Buckingham hungered for the glory and adventure that would add to his fame. He was bored with his limited tasks, and he pouted and whined about this. The ambassador first flattered him profusely. The Duke was the ablest man in the country, and it was a shame he was given so little to do. Then he began to whisper to him of a great adventure. The Duke, as Gondomar knew, was in favor of the match with the Spanish princess, but these damned marriage negotiations with King James were taking so long and getting nowhere. What if the Duke were to accompany the king's son, his good friend, Prince Charles, to Spain? Of course, this would have to be done in secret, without guards or escorts, for the English government and its ministers would never sanction such a trip. But that would make it all the more dangerous and romantic. Once in Madrid, the prince could throw himself at Princess Maria's feet, declare his undying love, and carry her back to England in triumph. What a chivalrous deed it would be, and all for love! The Duke would get all the credit, and it would make his name famous for centuries. The Duke fell for the idea, and convinced Charles to go along. After much arguing, they also convinced a reluctant King James. The trip was a near disaster. Charles would have had to convert to Catholicism to win Maria, and the marriage never happened, but Gondomar had done his job. He didn't bribe the Duke with offers of money or power. He aimed at the childlike part of him that never grew up. A child has little power to resist. It wants everything, now, and rarely thinks of the consequences. A child lies lurking in everyone, a pleasure that was denied them, a desire that was repressed. Hit at that point, tempt them with the proper toy, adventure, money, fun, and they will slough off their normal adult reasonableness. Recognize their weakness by whatever childlike behavior they reveal in daily life. It is the tip of the iceberg. Napoleon Bonaparte was appointed the Supreme General of the French Army in 1796. His commission was to defeat the Austrian forces that had taken over northern Italy. The obstacles were immense. Napoleon was only 26 at the time. The generals below him were envious of his position and doubtful of his abilities. His soldiers were tired, underfed, underpaid, and grumpy. How could he motivate this group to fight the highly experienced Austrian army? As he prepared to cross the Alps into Italy, Napoleon gave a speech to his troops that may have been the turning point in his career and in his life. He said, "Soldiers, you are half-starved and half-naked. The government owes you much, but can do nothing for you. Your patience, your courage do you honor, but give you no glory. I will lead you into the most fertile plains of the world. There you will find flourishing cities, teeming provinces. There you will reap honor, glory, and wealth." The speech had a powerful effect. Days later, these same soldiers, after a rough climb over the mountains, gazed down on the Piedmont Valley. Napoleon's words echoed in their ears, and a ragged, grumbling gang became an inspired army that would sweep across northern Italy in pursuit of the Austrians. Napoleon's use of temptation had two elements. Behind you is a grim past, ahead of you is a future of wealth and glory if you follow me. Integral to the temptation strategy is a clear demonstration that the target has nothing to lose and everything to gain. The present offers little hope. The future can be full of pleasure and excitement. Remember to keep the future gains vague, though, and somewhat out of reach. Be too specific, and you'll disappoint. Make the promise too close at hand, and you won't be able to postpone satisfaction long enough to get what you want. The barriers and tensions in temptation are there to stop people from giving in too easily and too superficially. You want them to struggle, to resist, to be anxious. Queen Victoria surely fell in love with her Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, but there were barriers of religion. He was a dark-skinned Jew. Class, she, of course, was a queen. Social taste, she was a paragon of virtue, he a notorious dandy. The relationship was never consummated, but what deliciousness those barriers gave to their daily encounters, which were full of constant flirtation. Many such social barriers are gone today, so they have to be manufactured. It's the only way to put spice into seduction. Taboos of any kind are a source of tension, and they are psychological now, not religious. You're looking for some repression, some secret desire that will make your victim squirm uncomfortably if you hit upon it, but will tempt them all the more. Search in their past. Whatever they seem to fear or flee from might hold the key. It could be a yearning for a mother or father figure, or a latent homosexual desire. Perhaps you can satisfy that desire by presenting yourself as a masculine woman or a feminine man. For others, you play the Lolita or the daddy, someone they are not supposed to have, the dark side of their personality. Keep the connection vague. You want them to reach for something elusive, something that comes out of their own mind. In London in 1769, Casanova met a young woman named Charpillon. She was much younger than he, as beautiful a woman as he had ever known, and with a reputation for destroying men. In one of their first encounters, she told him straight out that he would fall for her and she would ruin him. To everyone's disbelief, Casanova pursued her. In each encounter, she hinted she might give in, perhaps the next time, if he was nice to her. She inflamed his curiosity. What pleasure she would yield. He would be the first. He would tame her. The venom of desire penetrated my whole being so completely, he later wrote, that had she so wished it, she could have despoiled me of everything I possessed. I would have beggared myself for one little kiss. This affair indeed proved his ruin. She humiliated him. Charpillon had rightly gauged that Casanova's primary weakness was his need for conquest, to overcome challenge, to taste what no other man had tasted. Beneath this was a kind of masochism, a pleasure in the pain a woman could give him. Playing the impossible woman, enticing and then frustrating him, she offered the ultimate temptation. What will often do the trick is to give the target the sense that you are a challenge, a prize to be won. In possessing you, they'll get what no other has had. They may even get pain. But pain is close to pleasure and offers its own temptations. In the Old Testament, we read that, quote, David arose from his couch and was walking upon the roof of the king's house, and he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful, unquote. The woman was Bathsheba. David summoned her, seduced her, supposedly, then proceeded to get rid of her husband, Uriah, in battle. In fact, however, it was Bathsheba who had seduced David. She bathed on her roof at an hour when she knew he would be standing on his balcony. After tempting a man she knew had a weakness for women, she played the coquette, forcing him to come after her. This is the opportunity strategy. Give someone weak the chance to have what they lust after by merely placing yourself within their reach, as if by accident. Temptation is often a matter of timing, of crossing the path of the weak at the right moment, giving them the opportunity to surrender. Bathsheba used her entire body as a lure. But it is often more effective to use only a part of the body, creating a fetish-like effect. Madame Récamier would let you glimpse her body beneath the sheer dresses she wore, but only briefly, when she took off her overgarment to dance. Men would leave that evening, dreaming of what little they had seen. Empress Josephine made a point of baring her beautiful arms in public. Give the target only a part of you to fantasize about, thereby creating a constant temptation in their mind. Reversal. The reverse of temptation is security or satisfaction, and both are fatal to seduction. If you cannot tempt someone out of their habitual comfort, you cannot seduce them. If you satisfy the desire you've awakened, the seduction is over. There's no reversal to temptation. Although some stages can be passed over, no seduction can proceed without some form of temptation, so it's always better to plan it carefully, tailoring it to the weakness and childishness in your particular target. Phase 2. Lead astray, creating pleasure and confusion. Your victims are sufficiently intrigued, and their desire for you is growing, but their attachment is weak, and at any moment, they could decide to turn back. The goal in this phase is to lead your victims so far astray, keeping them emotional and confused, giving them pleasure but making them want more, that retreat is no longer possible. Springing on them a pleasant surprise will make them see you as delightfully unpredictable, but will also keep them off balance. Chapter 9, keep them in suspense. What comes next? The artful use of soft and pleasant words will intoxicate them and stimulate fantasies. Chapter 10. Use the demonic power of words to sow confusion. Aesthetic touches and pleasant little rituals will titillate their senses, distract their minds. Chapter 11. Pay attention to detail. Your greatest danger in this phase is the mere hint of routine or familiarity. You need to maintain some mystery, to keep a little distance, so that in your absence your victims become obsessed with you. Chapter 12. Poeticize your presence. They may realize they're falling for you, but they must never suspect how much of this has come from your manipulations. A well-timed display of your weakness, of how emotional you have become under their influence, will help cover your tracks. Chapter 13. Disarm through strategic weakness and vulnerability. To excite your victims and make them highly emotional, you must give them the feeling that they're actually living some of the fantasies you have stirred in their imagination. Chapter 14. Confused desire and reality. By giving them only a part of the fantasy, you will keep them coming back for more, focusing your attention on them so that the rest of the world fades away. Even taking them on a trip will lead them far astray. Chapter 15. Isolate your victim. There is no turning back.